My name's Nick, and I'm going to be talking about genital inguinal lymphogranuloma venereum, or LGV for short, presenting in men taking HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis, and the implications for genital ulcer disease and how we think about that and managing that in the populations that we see in sexual health settings. I'd like to thank ASHAM and the Sexual Health Conference for the opportunity to present on behalf of my colleagues and Sydney Sexual Health Centre. So lymphogranuloma venereum has been endemic in countries in our region for quite some time, as well as in Australia. We've seen outbreaks in the last 10 to 15 years, particularly in dense sexual networks of men who have sex with men living with HIV. In the UK and in Europe in the last 20 years, we've seen cases, an epidemic among more highly active, sexually active men who have sex with men with HIV with proctitis, so a syndrome that a lot of us will be familiar with in sexual health medicine. But genital ulcers have been uncommon, and in Australia they've been exceedingly rare in all population groups. So a few things to bear in mind here. The ratio in the UK of genital inguinal disease to proctitis is about 1 in 15. That gives you a sense of how uncommon genital ulcers caused by LGV is. But in high prevalence countries, only about 10% of genital ulcers are thought to be caused by LGV. So still a relatively uncommon differential diagnosis when we're thinking about genital ulcers. In terms of the enigma of LGV and how it spreads, there's been a number of proposed mechanisms, but there are there's a lot of element of uncertainty about this. As you can imagine, an infection that tends to have a predilection for the anorectal mucosa raises some questions about transmission as well. Is there pressure in the way that this is presenting due to changes in antimicrobial use? We now routinely in sexual health clinics use doxycycline for chlamydia. Is there an element of tissue tropism as well? So LGV is known to have a fairly predictable clinical course in terms of its timelines, but it's worth bearing in mind that the early symptoms can be missed frequently as well. It's a difficult disease to diagnose because of the variety of its clinical manifestations and really a lack of a uniform presentation in all people. But in its primary stage, it takes on two forms: either a proctitis-like syndrome or a primary lesion, a genital ulcer, classically on the coronal sulcus of the penis, the vulva, and some other sites in the lower genital tract. It's usually self-resolving, usually pain-free, and there can be associated lymphadenopathy. But it then progresses to this well-known secondary stage, and this might be the first way that our patients present if the initial genital ulcer has been overlooked, and it frequently is. So unilateral inguinal and femoral lymphadenopathy with or without bubo formation. Systemic symptoms can present, but if this is untreated, this can progress to more advanced disease with chronic tissue destruction, inflammation, fibrosis, and scarring. There can also be a long-term risk of squamous cell carcinoma development in line with other untreated anogenital dermatoses. So moving on to our cases, we saw a 35-year-old man in our clinic taking pre-exposure prophylaxis for HIV prevention with a 10-day history of a penile ulcer that was actually painful alongside an enlarging left inguinal mass. Although he was well, he'd had this mass for over a week, and he came in with some recent sexual history, as we can note there. He'd had bacterial STI in the last 12 months, namely early latent syphilis. And on examination, we saw a 1 centimetre diameter non-indurated ulcer and some tender left inguinal mass with normal vital signs and no signs of active syphilis elsewhere. So the above tests were sent and he received comprehensive STI testing, as well as herpes and syphilis PCR swabs from the ulcer base. Chlamydia trachomatis swab was sent from the ulcer base. Owing to initial concerns about follow-up, however, we opted to treat him empirically for what was felt to be the most likely diagnosis, a chancre, primary syphilis, with 2.4 million units of benzathine penicillin. He did actually follow up 3 days later, however, and the ulcer was unchanged. A new, smaller second ulcer had developed, and his inguinal mass was now larger. It was also more uncomfortable. The initial tests all returned negative with the exception of chlamydia from the ulcer base, and that was then automatically referred for LGV PCR. He was given doxycycline and he then then followed up 7 days later. His ulcers were receding, but the mass was increasingly painful. And on the day he was reviewed 7 days later, the LGV result was available. So from reflex testing from the chlamydia, PCR from the ulcer base. Because the mass was increasingly uncomfortable, we referred for aspiration of the inguinal mass. This was done on day 6 doxycycline. The chlamydia, interestingly, was negative from the fine needle aspirate. Bacterial culture, no growth, but it did show changes of granulomatous inflammation and some hyperplastic changes. No abscesses, no tissue necrosis. We followed him up at treatment completion and his symptoms had all resolved. We'll just move on to talk about case two and then some of the interesting points of reflection in terms of LGV in our populations. So in terms of case two, a man of similar age, taking HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis daily, he attended, referred in by his general practitioner with a 4-day history of a painful, swollen penile shaft. Really what clinically looked very much like cellulitis. He was systemically well, without fevers, and he reported multiple episodes of condomless insertive anal sex in the last 4 weeks with several casual male partners. No recent travel. And I should mention in our first patient, his recent partners had been in Thailand as well as Australia, unlike this chap who had not travelled recently. A penile ultrasound had been organised by the general practitioner and that revealed soft tissue edema, but there were no collections and there were no vascular or lymphatic changes. The doctor had ordered comprehensive 3-site testing and that had revealed chlamydial urethritis. He'd also so commenced doxycycline for the same, 100 milligrams 12 hourly, and he'd been on that for 2 days prior to when he was seen. All other testing was negative or non-reactive. So when we examined this patient, we saw a very small, subtle, superficial ulcer, non-indurated, inside the urethral meatus, adjacent to a Prince Albert piercing. And I think that raises an interesting point as to the extent to which the piercing may have acted as a nidus of entry for the infection. There's been a recent case report within the last decade from a Sydney clinic of a patient with multiple bacterial and viral STIs presenting at the time of a Prince Albert piercing change. So always an interesting thing to consider in our patients that have genital piercings. This patient had a markedly swollen red tender area on the penile tissue, the mid-shaft of the dorsal penis extending back to the penile base, resembling cellulitis and not pictured. His vital signs were normal and there were no signs of syphilis. There was no inguinal lymphadenopathy. So of the tests sent, of note was the decision to test the ulcer for chlamydia as well as syphilis and herpes simplex. We sent a bacterial culture swab. At the time of referral, no tests had been sent from the urethral meatus ulcer, although it wasn't clear whether he had the urethral meatus ulcer 2 days earlier presenting to his general practitioner. He certainly had those changes consistent with cellulitis to the penile shaft. Our initial thoughts were the possibility of a group A strep infection or a similar cause of cellulitis. We transferred him to the emergency department. He was admitted for 2 days under the infectious diseases team at the local hospital and treated with piperacillin tazobactam and then on discharge amoxicillin clavulanic acid. But he also continued his doxycycline throughout his hospital admission. So when he was seen 5 days later, day three after discharge and day seven of his doxycycline, the only reactive or positive microbiological test from the entire time that he was under our and hospital's care was the chlamydia from the ulcer base of the urethral meatus. That was then sent for reflex LGV testing. And he was commenced on extended on doxycycline to 21 days. So the LGV swab had come back reactive in that fellow, and we followed him up at the completion of treatment. All his symptoms had resolved. So two cases of genital inguinal LGV seen within a 3 to 4 month period at a busy metropolitan Sydney sexual health clinic. So what are the lessons here? In terms of LGV diagnosis, it can be tricky. It's the challenges really involve this being an uncommon presentation, an uncommon cause of genital ulcer disease that we know of so far in Australia, although watch this space. There's no uniform way that it can present, and in its early stages where we know that treatment can make a big clinical difference, the signs and symptoms can easily be overlooked by patients and clinicians. We don't know if we're missing these cases in sexual health clinics. In terms of making that diagnosis, it's about considering risk factors for LGV, and certainly from the European and UK experience, men who have sex with men living with HIV are thought to be at highest risk. A recent history of bacterial STIs. Contact with chlamydia might be a clue. Recent travel in one observational study has predicted LGV, and certain other behavioural factors as well. Might there be immunological risk factors? We don't know. A recent study from the UK LGV case finding group, and it's not the first study that's shown this, has linked LGV to older age among men having sex with men. So could there be an element of immunopathology there in terms of the tendency to develop LGV rather than clear a chlamydia infection? It's an interesting point for reflection. In terms of its symptoms, we know that it can cause proctitis. We know from developing countries it's more likely to present in its genital inguinal form in terms of genital ulcer disease. But we don't know if we're missing cases of genital ulcerative LGV in Australia. Rectal chlamydia is a very important marker for us to be thinking about it. And really, there might be an argument for a period of surveillance in Australia where we decide that we might change our testing algorithm. And there may be an argument to be made for referring rectal chlamydia swabs that are positive among men who have sex with men living with HIV for LGV testing for surveillance. It can also we can also make the diagnosis through tissue specimens. Histopathology has some classical findings, but really the cornerstone is lymphogranuloma DNA testing. And in the Sydney setting, this is referred to ICPMR at Westmead. It's done in a reflex way from a lot of laboratories, so we don't need to recollect our samples. But clinicians in primary care or in other settings will need to make sure that their labs are equipped to do this as well. The LGV PCR can take up to 2 weeks to return a positive result. However, chlamydia from the ulcer base has a much quicker turnaround time. And then if it's, it can then be referred on if it's positive. Syphilis serology can help to rapidly rule out syphilis in its primary form, but we need to use it with caution. It doesn't always rule out syphilis early in the infection before seroconversion has occurred. So briefly, some recent cases of genital ulcer LGV in Australia have emerged over the last 5 to 10 years, and really the lessons here are illustrative. In one case in 2013, buboes presented after a self-resolving genital ulcer diagnosed and treated as a chancre. And then in a case published last year, in two cases, I should say, at two different sexual health clinics, similar type pictures really, illustrating some prompts for us to really think about how we test and how we approach genital ulcer disease. So in short, we may be missing LGV in our genital ulcers, and there can be a risk of disease progression. So thinking about testing for chlamydia early or initially, and particularly among those at risk when we've ruled out herpes and syphilis. Carefully considering genital ulcers in that setting, and surveillance may be key in the age of increasing STIs, seromixing and biomedical HIV prevention. Thinking about a travel history and those that may have been to other countries and sexually active in our region, and thinking about surveillance of LGV and how it presents with amid potential future changes to doxycycline use, including for STI prophylaxis. So that concludes my talk. I'd like to acknowledge the patients involved and my colleagues involved, as well as all others involved in the patient's care. Thank you very much.